offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I have the privilege of joining you again this week from our studios at Prashanti Nilayam. And I'm here to continue with the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita and most likely complete it today, and I think I should complete it today. In fact, I was thinking of completing it last week, but I'm glad we didn't rush through the whole thing because the last two shlokas are very, very important. There are a few very beautiful and profound concepts that have been conveyed in these last two shlokas of the third chapter, which more or less summarize the entire discourse that happens in this last part where Arjuna has asked a question and Krishna is answering. So I'm glad that we did not rush through it and we have one more session to go through that in the detail that it deserves. So as always, let's begin this week's episode by starting with a short summary of what we have covered so far. And hopefully we'll be able to cover in detail the two remaining shlokas of the third chapter. Somewhere around the 40th verse, Krishna started by telling Arjuna about where the enemy of desire resides, right? That was the shloka we started off with last time. He explained that desire is the enemy, and then in the 40th verse, he started explaining where this desire resides and what is the strategy that it employs. He said that the senses, the mind and the intellect are its adhishtanam, or its seat, or its residing place. And what is the strategy that they operate with? He said, operating through these three, it deludes and eventually covers the wisdom. And one of the hints that Krishna had given earlier is that these desires that we are talking about are born of the quality of rajas. And that means even these three, the senses, the mind and the intellect, come under the influence of rajas. That is what Krishna means by saying that the enemy of desire resides in these three. So what is the rajasic activity of the senses? When they get extremely agitated, when they come in contact with objects that the senses are known to crave for. And what is the rajasic nature of the mind, or nature of the mind when it is under the influence of rajas? As we had discussed last week, the multi-pointedness or the distracted state of the mind. We had seen that this happens in two ways, either because the senses are themselves running after something and dragging the mind along, or the senses have allowed inputs into the mind and the mind tends to contemplate on these and be distracted even in the absence of the senses themselves running. So how does this affect the buddhi? Buddhi is the intelligence, and when pulled by our desires and self-interest, the intelligence also becomes a tool of these desires or becomes a slave of these desires. Swami would call this particular flaw of the buddhi or the inner instrumentality as karana apatvam. Right? I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Karana apatvam. This is a phrase that Swami had used, I think, in the 1990 Samako series. When we had gone through the Shravana Mananam series, we had spoken about this in detail, where karana means instruments. And here the reference is to the antakarnas. The antakarnas are the inner instruments of manas, buddhi, chitta, ahankara. We'll be talking a little more in detail about these four instruments in today's episode. So Swami would say that when motivated by selfishness or by our desires, the buddhi or the inner instruments are contorted and they work in a manner that they should not be working, or they have a distortion. They work in a distorted manner, if I could put it that way. So Swami would, in fact, talking about this karana apatvam, Swami gives a very beautiful chinakata. And we had gone through that in the 1990 Samako series again, where Swami says there is a village where there is a very rich farmer, something like a zamindar, and there is a middle-class farmer who has a small piece of land. And as generally it goes, in some of these analogies and stories, the richer farmer is very arrogant and very dominating, and the poor farmer is a meek, simple man. So it so happens that each one of them, they have their own cattle and their livestock. At one point, the bull that belongs to the rich farmer and a bull that belongs to the poor farmer. Both get into a fight at the place where they're grazing. And the poor man's bull ends up killing the rich man's bull. And Rami would say that this man gets so perturbed because he knows the rich farmer is known for his bad temper. So he runs to the rich man to report to him. He thought that it's better he hears it from me than it reaches him through somebody else. And he's so flustered and he's so scared and tensed, he ends up narrating the incident exactly in the reverse. Instead of saying that his bull killed the rich farmer's bull, he ended up saying that the rich farmer's bull had killed the bull that belongs to him. And when he says this, Swami tells, you know, the farmer looks at him and says, you know, see, these are all animals and animals don't have intelligence. Man who has intelligence himself ends up killing and harming each other. What then can we say about animals which don't have an intelligence? So he says, this happens, you know, we cannot be held responsible for such acts. And even as the rich farmer is giving this discourse in a very mature and balanced manner, the poor man realizes that he has told the thing in the wrong way. And he says, sir, I have committed a huge blunder. I have given you the wrong version of the accident. I am very sorry. What has actually happened is my bullock has killed yours. And the moment the poor farmer says this, the rich man becomes very, very angry and says, how dare you come and tell me this and how can this happen? And you better pay me 500 rupees for the loss that I've had. So Swami would say that it's the same intelligence that the person is using. It's not that you don't know. When you're driven by your desire, when you're driven by your self-interest, it contorts your intelligence. And it's a typical example that Swami would give of that quality of Karana Apathvam, where the intelligence is there, but it is being contorted by your self-interest and by your desires. So Krishna says, the desire born of rajas is placed in the senses, the mind and the buddhi, and it uses them or contorts them to delude the wisdom which is there, be it whoever you are, be it a good man or a cruel man, be it a saint or a sinner, whoever it is, the wisdom is always there. But the desire which contorts, the desire which takes its position in the mind, the senses and the buddhi, ends up clouding the wisdom in this manner. But we discussed how it is not bad altogether, this quality of rajas. Rajas is the guna of activity, right? The point that is being made here by Krishna is that of balance, to have that balance. And the first step to achieve this balance is what Krishna explains in the next shloka, which is shloka number 41. He says, first and foremost, start by regulating the senses. And as we had discussed the last time, the actions and words, the expression and the intake, all of these happens through the senses, and so the senses have to be regulated. And we had discussed how this is not easy. It is not like this is easier than, or this is very easy to do. That is why this has to be done. Certainly it's not easy, because even when trying to regulate the senses, our inner tendencies do play an important part. But what we had seen was, it is the best place to start from, because it is definitely easier to control the senses in the body than to control the thoughts, and even more close to impossible to control the subconscious mind, right? So that was one of the things that we had talked about, and we had concluded with the point that is why satsanga or good company is very, very important. When we are in an environment where the visuals, what we hear and what we discuss are all noble, it is easier to regulate the mind, and eventually one's nature also gets changed in that manner. So this is where we had stopped, and we had also seen how to understand the place and role of all these instruments is very, very important. Right, the hierarchy or the order or who is superior to whom. In fact, that is what Krishna is going to explain in the next verse that we are going to go through. That is verse number 42. It's a very important, very beautiful verse. The next two verses are very beautiful. The way they are structured and the concepts they are conveying are very beautiful and very important in our spiritual understanding. So we'll listen to verse number 42, beautifully and clearly rendered by Brother Shyam. I'll give you a brief meaning of what Krishna is saying there, and we do have a lot to discuss after that. So first we'll listen to the shloka.
Indriyani paranyahuh indriyebhyah param manah manasastu para buddhih yo buddhe paratastu saha.
They say that the organs are superior. The mind is superior to the organs, but the intellect is superior to the mind. However, the one who is superior to the intellect is he. So that is the meaning of verse number 42. Now, Krishna has said that you must control the senses to begin with. He said, Indriyani adau niyamya. To start with, control the senses. This could mean that first control the senses, that's the simple meaning, and then you can rein in the mind and the intellect. Or it can also mean that these three can be controlled by first controlling the senses. I hope you understand the two ways of looking at it. One is, these senses are easier to control, so start with that. Or it can be said that to control all of these three things, the senses, the mind and the buddhi, it is the senses that have to be controlled first. Either way, there is a very, very important point that is being made here. We can control only what is not us. I can control only what is not me. I can control what is mine, but I don't control myself in the true sense. I know that in regular language we use phrases such as, you must have self-control, or I lost my self-control, or I lost control of myself, I should have had more self-restraint. These are all common phrases that we use in our regular parlance. But when we use such phrases, what are we really referring to? We are really referring to the senses, mind and the intellect, isn't it? Especially the senses, most of the time. When we say self-control, it means I don't speak anything in anger, and I don't say something that I regret later, or I don't do things that I know that I'm not supposed to do and later I feel bad about them. That's what we refer to as self-control when you say I've lost my control or that person is a person of much self-restraint. This is what it means. It is somebody who has control over the senses. So even when we say self-control, we are only referring to controlling these instruments. I am only trying to control what is mine. The real me is the one who is trying to do this, isn't it? And every time we say something like what Arjuna has asked, I want to do this with my life but I'm not able to, it means that we are acknowledging that this body-mind complex is separate from me and it is not obeying me, or I am trying to make it obey me. I think this is actually a little complex to understand. It's a confusion that we all get into. We shift from this idea of me and mind, you and yours, constantly. I think this is in the way we talk, in the way we think. We constantly keep making this difference between, this jump between the real person and what belongs to that person. Me and mine, you and yours. It's actually a little difficult to explain, but let me try, and hopefully with the Swami's grace will be able to get a little bit clarity on this. Let's say I am driving a car. Now the car can do a few things, like it can go at different speeds, it can start, it can stop, it can turn left or right. Now the access to all these things that the car can do are with me through the steering, the gears, the clutch, accelerators and brakes, right? So these are the access instruments that I have to control this car, right? The better driver I become, what I think I can make the car do. If I want to go slow, the car will go slow. If I want to turn right at a precise angle, I can make the car do that. Which means I have become a better driver, right? So this is applicable to all the instruments that we use. Say even a music instrument. The difference between an amateur and an expert is, an expert can make the instrument do what he or she wants it to do. There is this very, very famous saxophonist, Kenny G, and he used to say this apparently. He would say that, you know, he's been practicing with the saxophone or he's been playing the saxophone for so many years that now that instrument has almost become like another limb of his body. And he would say, just like how when I, you know, when you or me want to scratch our nose, I just think and the hand raises to the nose and it does the act of scratching. He says, similarly, I just think of a tune or a note and my fingers play it on the instrument, my breath blows accordingly. So it's literally become like another arm that he's having. And same is the case with the good driver that we were talking, right? In fact, one of the best drivers that I have seen is the driver who used to drive Swami's car, Mr. Padmanabhan. And when he used to drive the car and Swami would tell him to take it into the portico, Swami would suddenly ask him to turn. He was such a fine driver that, you know, he would exactly, he needed a very small space to maneuver the car around. And we would look at the expertise with which he would drive Swami's car. So that's what a good driver can do. Whatever he thinks, he can make that car do, just like how a good instrumentalist thinks and is able to bring out that same impact or the same expression in his instrument. So the point that I'm trying to make here is, when you think that an instrument is part of you, or when you are able to play an instrument so well, you think that it is a part of you. And let's say if there is a problem with any of the access points when you're talking about the instrument, let's say some keys are not working, or when you're talking about the car, let's say the brakes have a problem or the clutch has a problem. Now, even if you're a very good driver, the car will not listen to what you're trying to do because there is a problem in the instruments. Now, something very similar with our relationship between a driver and the car, a musician and his instrument, is what happens with who we really are and our bodies and our senses and the mind and the rest. Since the execution of our command is so seamless, as I said, I just want to scratch my nose, I think it, my hand raises up and goes about it, we forget that we are not this body. Now, even as I'm doing this program, I'm thinking of words and my mouth is speaking them seamlessly. Now, even as I'm speaking, if I feel that the volume that I'm speaking in is not good enough, my hand automatically goes to the mixer in front of me, the equipment in front of me, and it raises the volume, right? It happens so seamlessly and so smoothly. The body follows the command of the mind in a manner which is so seamless that we forget that the body is separate from the mind is separate from the intellect, and who I really am is separate, right? And when we are not able to do what we want to, like how Krishna has been asked by Arjuna, I want to do this, I'm not able to do this. I want to wake up early in the morning, but I'm not able to wake up early in the morning. I want to speak the truth, but I'm not able to. These are the places where this human experience itself is throwing up a hint that we are not this body-mind complex, right? And this acknowledgement of separateness is very, very important for sense control or mind control. For me to master them, the first point is I should recognize that these are only my instruments. And next comes the hierarchy, right? That is what Krishna is speaking about. So these are two very, very important points. One is, I am not this body. I am not the senses. I am not the mind. I am not even the buddhi. This idea of separateness is very, very important if I want to control them. And now the hierarchy. In the first line, Krishna refers to the hierarchy and he says, Indriyani, the senses, parani, are superior, ahuhu. They say, though Krishna doesn't say body, what is being told here is, he starts by saying the senses are superior to the body. It is said so. When we say body, it is what we refer to as the annamaya kosha or the gross body, right? It is made of food. Literally, it's like a dress that we wear. Krishna had used that analogy in the second chapter. And this is like a dress which is actually growing. Imagine that I have a dress which stretches and grows and gets wrinkled and so on and so forth. So literally this body is made of food that I've been piling up all through my lifetime. Last week in the afternoon satsang, I was actually giving this example. Imagine there is a pair of gloves in front of me, right? If I were to put my hand into the glove will do everything I do with my fingers inside the glove, right? If I give a thumbs up, it will do that. And if I show four fingers, three fingers, the glove will do exactly that. But the moment I pull out my hand from the glove will become inanimate or motionless, right? And that is the same thing with the body too. Swami says the body is the gross, the stula sharira, and the hand that I put into the glove is something like the sukshma sharira. The sukshma sharira goes into this this body which is otherwise inert, and then you see it speaking, you see it dancing, and you see it walking, you see it sitting and standing and all of that, right? And another point that Swami would make, which is very, very important to understand, is the organs, the sense organs, like the eyes, the nose, and the skin, and the hearing, and all that, is still part of the body. But when Swami says senses, when Swami is referring to Indriyani here, the senses, Swami says, the reference is to the faculty of speech, the faculty of seeing, the faculty of hearing, right? And when we spoke about the car having some problem with the clutch or the gear or the steering. Similarly, when we say the sukshma sharira certainly has these faculties, whatsoever the condition of the body. But depending on the condition of the body, there is an expression. If the eyesight is not fine, in the body, if the hearing equipment is not fine, then the faculty seems to be absent. But the sukshma sharira has these faculties of the five senses intact all the time, right? That's another point that Swami would often say. So the sense organs are part of the body, but when we say the senses, the references is to the faculty of cognition which works in conjunction with the mind. So Krishna says, Indriyani Parani Ahuhu. It is said that the senses are superior to the body. Now, how are the senses superior to the body? The senses, again, are the faculty of hearing, speaking, listening, and so on and so forth. Now, how does Krishna say that the senses are superior to the body? This comes from the fact that the senses are subtler than the body. This is, again, a point that Swami would make in his discourses. He would say that the senses are subtler than the body. The body is gross. The senses are little more subtler than the body itself. Why does being subtler make the senses superior? When we talk of the body, you know, we refer to it as stula sharira. It is limited to its own form. When I say my body, it starts from the tip of my toe and it ends on the tip of my head or the top of my head. And that is all I am. I might be a millionaire, I could be the king, I could be an astronaut, I could be somebody who owns half the earth, but still my body will be only from the tip of my toe to the top of my head. In fact, this is one experience that all people who come for the first time to Swami say, that when they first come and see Swami, they suddenly realize that as a person, as a physical person, he's actually quite small, right? So even God, if he comes in the human form, his body appears only from the tip of his toe to his top of his head, from this end of his right hand to that end of his right hand, if I could put it that way, right? So the body is limited to its form. So when I say the body is gross, it is only what space it occupies. But when I speak about, say, the faculty of sight, though the eyes are only few centimeters in diameter, what I can see actually is probably a few kilometers away, right? In fact, I can stand here and look up into the sky and see stars, the sun and the moon, which are thousands of kilometers away. So though the body is restricted to the space that it occupies, these faculties of sight, for example, can reach out to distances which are thousands and thousands of miles away from the body itself. And same is the case with the faculty of hearing. And if you talk about the faculty of sensation of the skin, you might think that you need to make body contact for that. But even otherwise, if you were to walk into a place, the sensation of heat, the sensation of cold, all of this, we feel it much, much more, much, much before we make physical contact with, say, fire or ice, right? Which means that all of these faculties have their range much larger than the physical body, right? So that is why it is said that the senses, being subtler than the body, are superior, because they have a gamut which is much larger than the physical body itself. Then Krishna goes on to say, Indriyebhyah param manah. Superior to the senses is the mind. Now, applying the same parameter of subtleness, the mind is certainly more subtle than the senses, isn't it? The eyes can see far, but still, though it can see to a great extent, it is still attached to the body. For example, they would say that when we look at the moon, we all have still seen only one side of the moon. We can see the moon, which is thousands and thousands of miles away, but still the side that we are seeing is the same side. If I have to see the other side of the moon, then this body has to physically go to the other side of the moon, and then the eyes can see the other face of the moon, right? So even though the senses can reach out to thousands of miles away, it is still firmly attached to this physical body. But when we talk about the mind, I can sit here and I can imagine places that I have never been to. I can be sitting here in Prashanthi Nilayam, but my mind can go all around the world, right? The mind has the ability, the senses do not. The senses are still attached to the gross body. There's another way of looking at this hierarchy of how the senses are lesser or the mind is superior to the senses. Sometimes the mind can negate the input that the senses offer. Swami would give this example that, you know, when you have some sort of a sickness or a malady, a medical condition, let's say like jaundice or malaria, you would find that whatever you eat is bitter, right? In a normal sense, if you give me something, if you give me a leafy vegetable, or if you give me a fruit which is unripe, when I take a bite of it, if it is bitter or if it is sour, I will tell you that this is the taste of this particular object you've given me to eat. But when I am sick, my mind knows that I am sick. And if I eat something and it is bitter, my mind can overrule the bitterness that the senses feel, and the mind can say that it is not that the food is bitter, because I am sick, I am finding this taste as bitter. So it, in a way, overrules or negates the input that the senses are giving, right? Or say you are walking down a dark road. You cannot see much, it's full of darkness, but then you can hear a car coming. Your eyes are not able to see the vehicle approaching, but your ears can hear that a vehicle like a car is approaching you, right? So the mind is able to put both the inputs that come from different senses and come up with an observation that is comprehensive. The idea that the car is approaching is not available to the eyes at this moment, but the mind takes the input from the ear and it passes on, I mean, it has this complete picture of the idea based on what are the inputs which are coming from different senses. So the observation that the mind makes is comprehensive, and in a way it overrules the observations that one or the other senses are able to offer to it. And in fact, we even see this in the case of people who have disabilities of one of the senses, right? You find that they're able to kind of make up with the keenness of their intelligence, right? So in all this, it means that the mind is actually superior to the senses. One is, it is subtler than the senses, and it has the ability to comprehend, it has a comprehensive cognition compared to any of the senses, and it can also negate the inputs that come from these senses. There's a third reason why the mind is considered superior than the senses, because the mind needs to be alert for the senses to do what they have to do. For instance, when I'm in a very deep sleep state, or say when I'm unconscious, you could come and open my eyes, or you could come and whisper something into my ear. I don't recognize that at all. It doesn't reach me at all. Or for that matter, if you're sitting in a classroom and you're daydreaming, which by the way, I'm an expert at, then even though you will be hearing the voice of the teacher, nothing enters your head because your mind is not alert to what is happening there. So the alertness of the mind is so important even for the inputs of the senses to reach you. And that is what makes the mind superior to the senses. And that's why Krishna says, Indriyebhyah param manah. Then Krishna goes on to say, Tu but manasah para buddhihi. Superior to the mind is the buddhi, the intellect. Some would say that the buddhi is superior, of course, one, because it is subtler than the mind, we will come to that. But Swami would say it is closer to the Atma than the mind, senses and the body. In fact, in the previous shloka, Krishna said, even the buddhi can be affected by desires. There's no doubt about that. But it is the buddhi alone that can dismiss that which is unreal, or that which we refer to as mithya. You know, Vedanta says that the world is mithya. But that is not available to our direct experience. The mind cannot completely come to that understanding based on what it sees or what it hears or that experience which is direct to it, right? This idea that what I am seeing as this manifest world around me is actually unreal is not available to the mind, nor is it available to the senses. But it is only the buddhi or the intellect which can do what is referred to as nitya anitya viveka. The discrimination between what is permanent and what is ephemeral, what is satya and what is mithya, what is real and what is apparently real, right? So this is, in fact, the essential reasoning which is required in spirituality, right? And for this, the buddhi has to literally negate all the experiences based on the mind, the senses and the body. And each of us has this buddhi. And that is what makes the buddhi superior, its ability to negate all of these things which present to you. Just like how I told, the mind can negate the input of the senses, the buddhi can negate the input of the mind, the senses and the body. And also it is closer to the Atman. That's a point which we are going to speak about in detail in a short while from now. So Krishna says that this buddhi is superior to the mind. And finally he says, Tu, but, buddhehe paratah, greater than even this intellect, saha, is he. Meaning, greater than the buddhi is the Lord, who is the Atma within. So on the one hand, Krishna is clearly stating how each of these is different from one another, and the fact that you and I are not any of this. So first, to acknowledge that we are separate from all these instruments is a important first step. And the second is, we are the master of all of these. When he says that more superior than even the buddhi is saha, is he, the idea is that we are that self. In fact, in the next verse, that is going to be made even more clear. Right? And third is understanding this hierarchy. Understanding this hierarchy will make you know in what order these commands have to be passed and followed, right? Just like how you have an army, you have a clear hierarchy, which means the hierarchy is followed in the sense of the commands being passed on from an higher official to the lower official. So to acknowledge this hierarchy also is very important, and that is why Krishna is giving this. It's very, very important what the mind, what the body is experiencing, the mind can negate it. This is an important point to keep in mind. And what the mind is experiencing, the buddhi can negate it. It's a very, very important point in the spiritual journey that we are going through. And the buddhi is still only an instrument and it is not me. Because if you look at it from the point of view of maturity, not all of us are still stuck up in the idea that I am the body. But we might still be stuck up in the idea that I am this mind, which is intelligent and which is making all these reasoning, which is doing all this spiritual understanding. We might even get stuck up in that idea. So it is very important to realize that we are neither the body, we are not the senses, and we are not even the mind, we are not even the buddhi. So how do we do this? Right? A few points have already been made by Krishna in this third chapter so far. The next shloka, which happens to be the last shloka of the third chapter, Krishna is going to add one more very important point by which he gives a very, very comprehensive methodology of how we are going to march towards this goal, which is realization of the self. Right? So we listen to the next verse, which is verse number 43, the last verse of the third chapter. And then I'll give you a brief meaning and we will discuss in detail.
Evam buddhe param buddhva samstabhyatmanamatmana jahishatrum mahabaho kamarupam durasadam.
Thus, knowing him who is superior to the intellect and restraining the self by the self, slay thou, O mighty armed Arjuna, the enemy in the form of desire who is hard to corner. So that's the final verse of the third chapter. This seems like a very, very simple shloka, and I should admit that even I thought it's a very simple shloka, and I was about to do the mistake of rushing through the shloka in the last episode itself. But thankfully, Swami did not allow us to do that, because it's a very, very important shloka which actually literally completes the answer that Krishna is giving Arjuna to the question that he has asked, which is an all-important question. This question that Arjuna had asked, why am I not able to do the right thing even when I want to? If you really look at it, this question can be rephrased into many of the questions that we often ask on the spiritual path. I can tell you that many of the questions that I have received as part of the answering booth, or questions that people tend to ask when we interact with youngsters, all of that can be rephrased and it'll be some form of this question that Arjuna is asking. You know, questions like how to differentiate between the voice of the conscience and the voice of the head, how to always do whatever Swami wants us to, how do we know what is right from wrong. So this question is very, very important, because all of these questions that I mentioned is a modified form of what Arjuna is asking. So what are the points that Krishna is making in this particular shloka, which makes it so very important and relevant? Yevam buddhehe param buddhva. That's what he starts by saying. Evam buddhehe param buddhva. Evam, thus, buddhehe param. The one who is superior to the buddhi, buddhva. Know that one, or recognize that one, or acknowledge that one. Samstabhya, restraining, atmanam, the self, atmana, by the self. Now, this is a very, very nice statement, the way it is coined and the meaning that it conveys. It says, samstabhya, atmanam, atmana. Restrain yourself using the self. The word atma is mentioned in two different forms, atmanam and atmana. And in Sanskrit itself, the word atma has these both meanings. Atma means the self, the divine self, which is within. But atma also means the smaller self, right? When we say atma jnanam, it means the knowledge of the superior self. But the word atma is also used for yourself, right? When you say I'm not getting the right word. When you say self-confidence, it may not necessarily mean the larger self in regular usage, right? It's something like that. Well, I mean, just like how we do it in English, right? When I say self, the word self can be used for selfishness self, or it can be used as the self, the supreme self, right? We're using the same word in both. Similarly, the word atma can be used for the divine atma as well as this smaller self. So here Krishna is making a reference to, if you look at it in that way, our clarity and our confusion. When he says, samstabhya atmanam atmana, in one statement Krishna is making a reference to the confusion that we have as well as the clarity that we have. When I say self-control, as I just mentioned, when I say self-control, self-restraint, I'm only talking about controlling the mind and the senses, which are actually not me, which means I am confusing myself with the mind and body and the senses each time I say self-control, self-restraint, and self-mastery, right? I am confusing that the self is the body, mind, and the senses. But when I speak of myself being the real self, I am saying that I am beyond the body, mind, and the senses. So we all are right now in this state where the confusion and the clarity coexist. When we acknowledge what Krishna was saying so far, that we are not the body, senses, and the mind, and even the buddhi, and we acknowledge that we are the self that is higher than all of this, even though it may not be completely established in our experience, you know, right? We only know it as a information that has come from the scriptures, or because Swami has told it to us, we accept it. Nevertheless, it is part of our thinking that I am not this body and the mind. I am the Supreme Self. I am the Divine Self. I am the Atma. So that clarity is there on one hand in the same mind, and also this confusion that I am this body, mind, and the senses. Each time I say, I am trying to self-control, I am trying to do this, or as Swami would say, when you say, how are you? You say, I am fine, which means the body is fine, the mind is fine. Without our knowledge, we are acknowledging or we are betraying this idea that I am this body and the senses. So both of these ideas, the clarity and the confusion, coexist in each one of our experience, each one of our thinking, each one of our minds. So with the assertion that I am the self, control these entities which you think is yourself. And that is the purport of what Krishna is saying. Samstabhya Atmanam Atmana. With the assertion that I am the Supreme Self, the Atma, control these entities which you think is yourself. And for that, reminding yourself who you are and realizing that you are the master of the buddhi, manas, the indriyas and the body is very, very important. So first Krishna said, control the senses. Then he said, purify the mind through the controlling of the senses, that is like cleaning the dust off the mirror. And now he is saying, empower the buddhi by reiterating that the self or the atma is the master. The buddhi has to obey. And for that, you have to keep reminding yourself who you really are. And this is probably the whole of the idea of practical spirituality in a capsule. In fact, this paragraph that I just mentioned to you, these 2-3 lines, I'm going to come back to that as the summary of this entire portion. Right? So that is what Krishna is trying to convey. As I mentioned to you, this question of how do you differentiate between the voice of the conscience and the voice of the mind is something that has come multiple times, even in the answering booth. In fact, one of the programs that I did as part of the answering booth, I had explained this in detail, and what I'm going to explain in the next few minutes is a concise version of that. That question was about how do you differentiate between the voice of the head and the voice of the heart. If any of you are interested in going through that whole thing, I think you can go and look it up. If you find it difficult to locate that particular episode, you can always feel free to write to me. I'll send you the link. So now let me try to explain that one statement which I said as being the essence of spirituality. Now we all are in the state of Dvaita Bhava, or the feeling of duality. We certainly wish that we have wisdom or jnana, which Swami would often say that Advaita Darshanam Jnanam. If you're in that state of Advaita, that's all is jnana, but we are not jnanis right now. So in the absence of that jnana, we are all in what we refer to as Dvaita Bhavam, or the feeling of duality. What is this Dvaita Bhavam in simple terms? We think that there is two. There is the divine and there is the illusion, the maya. There is the real and the unreal. There is the satya and there is the mithya, right? We all think that I am not divine, Swami is divine, or I am a human being, and there is a Lord up in the heavens who's ruling over us, right? So we all have this Dvaita Bhavam, and Swami would say that this Dvaita Bhavam exists even in this human experience. the Atma is the divine aspect and the mind is the Maya aspect. Now this mind has four components based on the four roles that the mind plays. Manas, Buddhi, Chitta and Ahankara. In this entire chapter we have been talking about these four, though we may or may not have mentioned all of these names. When Krishna was speaking about each one of us having a nature or a prakriti or swabhava which controls us like a remote control, we don't know who is doing it, but somebody from inside seems to be commanding and we are following, right? That's a concept we've been talking about repeatedly in this portion of the third chapter. What we were referring to as impressions from within, the subconscious, all of this which are based on past actions, the past choices that we've made, the past lifetimes that we've had, these are all references to the chitta aspect of the mind, the storehouse of all my memories and tendencies. So when I am trying to do what is dharmic, it is my nature that is in this chitta component of the mind that tends to stop me, right? And when Krishna said the tendencies in the subconscious make its presence felt in the conscious mind as raga and dvesha, likes and dislikes, the conscious mind that he was referring to is the manas aspect, the aspect through which we are thinking, we contemplate, and we are able to operate the body and the senses. So the nature part is in the chitta aspect. The conscious mind is what we refer to as manas. And the buddhi we've been discussing, it is the discriminating ability of the mind. So when Krishna says the buddhi is superior to all of this and is closest to the Atma, one of the analogies that helps us understand this better is that of the horse-driven chariot, right? We've been going through that, the analogy of the Kathopanishad. The Atma is the master. The charioteer is the buddhi, who is supposed to take instructions from the master and guide the chariot and the horses, which are the senses and the body, right? The chariot is the body, the horses are the senses. And he is able to do this using the reins, which are the conscious mind. And last week we spoke of how this hierarchy is reversed when the horses go astray, right? But there's another analogy which we can use to understand this better. And I think I had used this analogy in the answer too. Imagine the buddhi to be a mirror. The Atma is the light that shines on this mirror, and this light from the surface of the mirror, which is actually the voice of the conscience. I know this might be a little confusing. I'll try to repeat that or try to go as slow as possible. Imagine the buddhi to be a mirror and the Atma to be a light source. So the light which reflects off the surface of the mirror is equivalent to what we refer to as the voice of the conscience. So voice of the conscience is nothing but the reflected effulgence of the Atma on the buddhi. I hope that was a little more clear. So you have this mirror, you have the Atma which is a light source, and it reflects off this buddhi, the light from the Atma, and it falls on what we refer to as the karmendriyas and the jnanendriyas, the instruments of action and the instruments of cognition. So when I'm supposed to act, the buddhi is supposed to draw light from the Atma and accordingly guide my karmendriyas and jnanendriyas. But now the surface of the mirror has this thick coating of dust. Now think of this dust as the tendencies that are stored in the chitta. Over many, many lifetimes, based on the choices that we've made and the actions that we've done, the fears that we've accumulated, the desires that we've accumulated, all of this forms this thick layer of dust on the buddhi. So now when in a situation I ask myself, what am I supposed to do? The light from the Atma reflecting on the mirror is always there, but its intensity is reduced because of this thick layer of dust. So on one hand, this dust from all the past births confuses the conscious mind, and added to that, we keep intaking more and more rajasic and tamasic content through our senses. So this makes it all the more difficult for us to follow our conscience, right? So now let us put into perspective all the instructions that Krishna has given so far based on this analogy that we have come across. I'll repeat that again. The buddhi is the mirror. The atma is the light source. The light reflects of the buddhi and it enlightens the karmendriyas and the jnanendriyas, which means the senses and the body and the mind and all of that. But there is this thick layer of dust on the mirror, which is what is referred to as our past tendencies, which tend to contort the instructions which come from the Atma. So what are the instructions that Krishna has given so far? First, he said, perform your assigned duty. Swami would often say that doing one's karma, doing one's dharma leads to chitta shuddhi. So that is the first point that Krishna had said when he said the do your swadharma, right? That was the first instruction that Krishna gave as a reply to the question that Arjuna asked. Second, he said, control the senses so that what you have to deal with is a little less complex. And over a period of time, this will also lead to replacing old vasanas with nobler ones, right? So this is typically like using sattva to wipe out the rajas which is there on this buddhi, right? And the third instruction that Krishna has given is what we have gone through in this particular shloka. He says, using the self, which is the atma, control this lower illusory self. And that is the third point that he is saying. And this needs a little bit of explaining, and I think that is what we'll do before I conclude. As I said, there are both the divine and the maya aspect in each one of us. The atma is the divine and the mind is the maya aspect. Why is the mind the maya aspect? Because it creates this illusion that I am separate from God and I am separate from each one of the person I come across with. I am separate from you, I am separate from my colleagues, I am separate from my family. It creates this illusion of individuality, right? And that component of the mind is what is referred to as ahankara or ego. That's the only one we have not come across. We spoke about manas, we spoke about chitta, we spoke about buddhi. We didn't speak about the ahankara. So this concept of this individuality, that is one more role the mind plays. The mind creates this illusion that you are a separate entity. And that is what is referred to as ahankara. And what we refer to as mind is, as I said, manas, buddhi, chitta and ahankara. So in Swami's discourses, Swami would say that the buddhi is certainly subtler than the senses in the mind or senses in the manas, and the atma is the subtlest. But when we look at the ahankara, Swami would say that the ahankara is subtler than the buddhi but less subtle than the atma. So it fits in between this place when you're talking about the degree of subtlety. It fits in between the atma and the buddhi, and that is why it creates the confusion. We saw the role of the manas, buddhi and chitta. What is the role of ahankara really? It is this idea of who we really are. Swami would say the word aham literally means I am. So ahankara literally means the idea of I am or I amness. Now in all our cases, we think that I am this body, or I am this mind, or I am Prem, I am this personality. And with it is attached, the moment I say I am Prem, so Prem's family, Prem's mother, Prem's brother and sister, Prem's family, husband and wife, and all of that comes along with that, right? That's why Swami would often say ahankara and mamakara are like two sides of the coin, where the idea of I am and what is mine, right? So the moment I say that I am this body, whatever is attached to this body also comes into that ambit. Now this mind as such, the whole idea of the mind, with all its components, it has two simple roles, which is self-preservation and self-propagation. So whatever this ahankara claims as I am, this whole complex mind with all its four components will try to protect this idea of I, because that is the role that the mind is meant to play, self-preservation. So the mind tries to protect me, my body, what I think of as my honor, my dignity. So all of this, it very, very vigorously tries to protect. And when anybody comes and tries to hurt either my body or my dignity or my respect, then I literally sear like a snake, right? Because that is the role of the mind. The mind is supposed to protect whatever I think I am. So all these qualities of anger and hatred and revenge and all of that come from this ahankara. Similarly, when I think that I am this person, when I think that I am my bank balance, when I think I am what I own, in the way of self-propagation, I want to grow. I want to become richer. I want to gather more. I want to have a family, right? All of that comes along with this idea of who I think I am. So the ahankara is the subtle cause, literally, for all the negative qualities that appear in the mind. So one of the ways to sublimate this is to constantly remind ourselves who we really are. As Krishna said, we are not the body, we are not the senses, mind or the intellect. We are the master of all of this, the self. And constantly reminding us of this is itself a means by which we are going to give the mind now a new identity to protect. If I constantly think I am the body and the mind, the self-preservation mechanism of the mind will try to protect it. But now I am giving a new identity to the mind, saying that I am the self. That's why the Mahavakya goes. Now instead of saying aham and attaching the body to it, I am attaching my reality to it and saying aham brahmasmi, right? I am Atma Brahma, as Swami would say. So when I think I am the body, the mind will constantly try to protect the body. When I tell myself that I am the Atma, the mind will now try to preserve and express this identity that I'm giving to it. But all this is very, very easy to describe, but this is like a constant struggle that we go through, right? It is like a lifelong battle. And that is what Krishna also tells in the final line of the third chapter. He says, Jahi Shatrum Mahabaho, slay this enemy, O mighty armed Arjuna, Kama Rupam Durasadam. It appears in the mind in the form of desires, Kama Rupam, but it is Durasadam, not very easy to counter. So that is what, in fact, Swami also says. Swami says, follow the master, fight till the end. And when Swami says fight till the end, it means fighting all of these qualities of the mind. And this is a relentless battle that has to go on. And that is why Krishna identified the enemy. He said the desire is the enemy. And he says, where does that desire hide? Even though you have identified the enemy, it's a very crafty enemy. You cannot go in front of it and kill it. But now Krishna has also given the mechanism in which this can be dealt with. And this is a problem all of us have. This is the hurdle that all of us have to cross to reach the goal. And the strategy that Krishna has given is three-pronged. It's very simple. It is very simple to follow, but it will take a long, long time for us to really achieve the end which these three simple steps are here to give us. So what are those three things? I had mentioned it. I'll repeat it again. He says, first, constantly perform your duty. Whatever is your duty towards your family, towards your profession, towards yourself, towards your body, you know, all of that comes under constantly performing your duty. Because doing your duty is clearing this chitta or wiping the dust of this buddhi. The second is control the senses. Control the inputs that go into the mind through the senses. That's why when Swami says, see only good, hear only good, speak only good, all of that comes into the second aspect of controlling the senses. Be in good company, read the right kind of things, see the right kind of things. So that is the second point. And the third, samstabhya atmanam atmana. By asserting your true identity as the Atma, control this illusory self of the body complex, body-mind complex. Right? That is the third instruction that he gives, and this is literally the summary of what we are all supposed to do with this human instrumentality that we have. Right? Do our assigned duty wherever we are placed, do what we are supposed to do. Swadharma, as Krishna had said. Control the senses, ensure that you have lesser to deal with by letting less dirt accumulate into this mind, and constantly assert yourself who you really are And through that assertion, control this body, mind, senses and the buddhi is what Krishna is saying. So it's a very, very beautiful last two shlokas, very comprehensively covers this whole, gives a comprehensive answer to this all-important question that Arjuna had asked. So I think I'm really glad that I did not rush through it. As I said, last week we had this opportunity to go through this. It's a very, very important two shlokas and so very beautifully and poetically expressed in these shlokas. And I can't thank you all enough for this, because thanks to all of you, I am able to go through this in such detail. And I most certainly very, very humbly and my heartfelt gratitude to the Swami and each one of you. And how really grateful we should be to Swami that he is allowing us to revisit his own words that he gave in the form of the Krishna avatar. Tomorrow is the Krishnashtami. We are celebrating the birth of this Lord, the Lord of Leela, the Lord of wisdom, right? And that's the fascinating nature of this beautiful avatar, and so much like our Swami, right? There was immense playfulness in his personality, but at the same time, the wisdom that is flowing from his being is so very profound, right? That years later we can sit and we can think close to 50 episodes and we're still in the third chapter, and that is how complex and how profound and deep these words of Krishna are. And even as we celebrate Krishnashtami, join me dear listeners in most humbly offering my salutations at the lotus feet of our Lord, our sweet Sai Krishna. I'll join you all again next week, maybe for the resumption of this Gita series, or we might have a special episode next week because it also happens to be the anniversary of Radio Sai, the day on which Swami came to this very recording floor I'm sitting in. It overwhelms me sometimes to think that in this very space, Swami sat for over 1 hour and charged this entire place, and he's giving us this opportunity to sit here week after week and connect with all of you. I thank you all for joining me again this week on the Gita series. I'll meet you all again next week at 7:30 p.m. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the last episode of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Till I meet you all next time, take care. Jai Sai Ram.